What about the theory that Pope Benedict resigned only part of the papacy? Apologist Michael Lofton is next. Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And our guest this time is apologist Michael Lofton. Michael Lofton has actually been quite critical of Pope Francis, and so we thought he was the perfect guy to ask about this theory that has been going around, whether or not Pope Francis actually holds all of the papacy, or whether some of it was reserved to Pope Benedict in the manner of his resignation, or if maybe the manner of the Pope's resignation means that all of it is still with Benedict. Here's what Michael Lofton had to say. Michael Lofton, the hardest working man in apologetics and affiliate apologist here at Catholic Answers. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me back on, Cy.
My take on you is you're not some crazy wild-eyed liberal, and you're very fair in your approach to assessing the situation in the church. So I wanted to talk to you about the just because I think that gives you a certain credibility to speak and be trusted on this whole question about the papacy with Pope Francis. Is he the Pope? Is he not the Pope? Mm-hmm. We have these two words, you have to tell me the two words now. I forgot them.
Ministerium and munus, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know mm-hmm. how to say the munus one. All right. and all that going on. So that's what I want to talk with you about today, right?
Absolutely. Sounds great. And I'm glad that you bring up that that point there about being conservative, because in fact, I am a conservative Catholic, and I do want to say that I do sympathize with many of the concerns and criticisms that have been made about the current pontificate. I just want to be guarded and make sure that we do so with caution and with charity. Those are my only concerns.
So you would not have a problem, and I'm not saying that you would say this, but you would not have a theological problem or even a practical problem with a person saying, I think Francis is a bad pope.
I don't have a problem with that. I think the concern is whenever someone publicly begins to slander Pope Francis, unfairly misrepresent him, distort the facts. That's when I would say we're going beyond fair criticism to mm-hmm. territory that I think is out of bounds. But just saying that I think that this is a very problematic pontificate, I don't think that that's uncharitable, and I do think that that is within the scope of our ability to say as laymen.
Okay, so because I don't want to put you in the position of, I mean, I'm sure that you could, if called upon to do so, you know, in the debating class or whatnot, make mm-hmm. a defense of Pope Francis. I'm not interested in either defending or attacking Pope Francis in this. Just simply mm-hmm. the theological and practical question of, can we say with confidence that he and not Benedict is the Pope?
Yeah, and I think that that's a fair way to approach this, because at the end of the day, if, in fact, Pope Francis were the worst pope that we have ever had in the history of the papacy, that doesn't mean that he's not actually the pope. Right? Those are two separate questions. So, you know, whether or not we think that this is a good pontificate or a bad one, that's a different question. So I'm glad, I'm happy with the way that you situated it here.
Yeah, but it's funny to think about, but the worst pope in history is the pope. Mm. He just happens to be the worst. So that's the fact. The worst pope in history, just like the best pope in history, they hold the same office.
You know, and I think that Peter being the first, if you will, pope, kind of anachronistic, but I mean, I'll grant it. He had some pretty significant failures. He had some moments of apostasy, you know, prior to his returning to the faith. So he set the bar pretty low in some aspects. So not that we haven't been equally guilty of great sins. We all have.
You realize he died a martyr for Christ, though. Like you said,
he finished very well. He finished very well.
He finished strong. Okay.
but the point is, there have been some very serious failures in the history of papacy, beginning without the very first pope.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that Peter wasn't the man that Christ said that he was. And that he did not possess the office that Christ gave him.
All right. So let's tackle the question then as it's posed. And I can actually remember the first time the question was posed to me about this idea of the office having different kind of, I don't know, the office being divided, I guess. Yeah. And it struck me as illogical. I mean, the point of the papacy is to have a public, visible vicar of Christ. And so the possibility that it could become a hidden office in which the world doesn't know who's the pope seems to me impossible. It can't, if the role of the thing is to be the vicar of Christ, then I can see there could be confusion, there could be, but that it can't be divided so that some part of it is hidden.
That's the key right there. The papacy can't be divided. And many who would take the position that Pope Francis is not the pope and Benedict XVI is the pope, some of them would actually grant that, yes, the papacy can't be divided. But here's the key. They would say, but Ratzinger or Pope Benedict thought the papacy could be divided. So in his resignation speech, he has a substantial error. And according to canon law, if you have a substantial error in your resignation, it's not valid. So they want to say, well, yeah, it's wrong to bifurcate the papacy between this ministry and office idea. That's wrong, but that was Benedict's view. And so perhaps he's in error in bifurcating it, yet that is enough to introduce doubt and substantial error in his resignation. So that's kind of their argument, is they would say, yeah, okay, sure, you can't divide the papacy, but Benedict thought that he could, and that spilled over into his resignation speech, which made it invalid. And we can take a deeper dive at that if you want to.
I do want to.
But that's effectively their argument.
Okay, so would you just explain the two terms to me then, munus and what's the other one?
Ministerium.
Yeah, that's what I knew. Yeah, that so, okay, go ahead.
So ministry and office. If we
ministry and office. Wanna, okay.
Yeah, let's just use the English terms. Ministry and office. So, what people will try to say is, okay, ministry and the aspect of ministry when it comes to the papacy pertains to the executive aspect, the writing of encyclicals or motu proprios, and you know, installing bishops or something like that. And munus pertains to just the office itself, which carries an obligation for prayer for the universal church, and caring for the universal flock, things like that. So they try to make that distinction there. And however legitimate maybe the distinction might be, we can't make an absolute division and say that, okay, you can have two people who share these things, right? So, well, maybe one person has the ministerium or the ministry of the papacy and the other one has the office. We can't separate these things. In the same way that we could say, well, Jesus is fully God and fully man, and we can make a distinction there, but you don't want to say, but those things are just separated, because now you kind of have the heresy of Nestorianism. So there's an analogy there. We could say, okay, maybe we can make distinctions here, but it's most certainly not the case that two people could share these distinctions. That's where the problem is. Now, they want to say in the resignation speech, he only renounced the ministry. He does not specifically renounce the office. So they want to say, well, since Benedict makes this distinction in his thought, they assume that he makes the distinction, this is a faulty resignation, because in fact you can't separate the two. And of course I can offer a response, but take it wherever you want.
Well, first of all, I guess I would like to ask, do you have any sense that Benedict intended anything other than to resign the papacy in whole, in totem, in toto, like that he was reserved in any way, or is there not, is the evidence to the contrary?
So what they will say is that if you look at young Ratzinger back in the 70s, he makes this distinction between ministry and office, and they want to read a little too much into that and assume that he means these things can be divided and shared by two people. I think they're reading too much into him. But when we look at Benedict, by the time he resigns, in 2013, whatever his former view was, which I don't think was incompatible, but whatever his former view was, by the time he's Benedict XVI in 2013, in his resignation speech, He shows no intention of bifurcating the papacy or leaving it partially vacant. In fact, and to me, this is the death blow to the Benevocantist position, the position that Benedict is still the Pope and Francis isn't. Here it is. He says in his resignation speech, if you don't mind me quoting, "I declare that I renounce the ministry of the Bishop of Rome, successor of St. Peter, entrusted me by the cardinals on 19th of April, 2005, in such a way, that as from February 28th, 2013 at 8 p.m., the See of Rome, the See of St. Peter, will be vacant and a conclave to elect the new Supreme Pontiff will have to be convoked by those whose competence it is." So at first he mentions that he's renouncing the ministry, and they want to say, you see, aha, he's renouncing the ministry, but not the office. But he says he's renouncing the ministry in such a way that the see will be vacant, not that it will be partially fulfilled, not that he will renounce the ministry but still retain the office. He wants to say, no, the see will be entirely vacant and the College of Cardinals will need to elect a new pope. It's clear in the intention that he doesn't mean to just resign only the mere ministry, but the entire office,
yeah,
so that the entire thing is vacant. And here's the thing. According to canon law, I believe it's canon 332, according to canon law, all that's required for the resignation of the pope is that it's free and manifest. He has elsewhere said most certainly and very explicitly that he was free in this resignation, and it's most certainly manifest that he resigns the entire office when he says the see will be vacant. To me, that's the death blow.
Okay, yeah, the see will be vacant. Have you heard any cogent response to that, or is that one that you have not heard?
I have not heard a response to that.
To that
the
point.
The best argument that I've ever heard is the idea that according to, I think it's canon 188, that in a resignation speech, if there's a substantial error in the speech, then it is invalid. And they want to say Benedict, in his mind, bifurcates the ministry and the office. Therefore, that's a substantial error. Therefore, he did not fully renounce the papacy, and now he's still the pope. But again, the problem is, I think, number one, they're reading too much into Ratzinger's thought on the distinction here. And then moreover, he makes his intention manifestly clear when he says that the see will be vacant. There's no way to read him otherwise. Moreover, I mean, in following interviews, he's confirmed that, hey, I'm no longer the pope.
Yeah. So a person such as yourself then, who comes to this conclusion, what do you make of the distinction then between these two, between office and ministry? Why even bother making that distinction? What is the point of ever having made that distinction? What did it accomplish? You know,
yeah.
Is a distinction, is there any purpose for that other than to say that it could, in fact, these two things could be exercised separately?
I do think that there's an importance for making the distinction. I think that's a really good question. Why is there this distinction? Although I don't think he makes the distinction rigidly in the resignation speech, what I will say is Ratzinger does make enough of a distinction, or Benedict XVI, Emeritus, whatever you want to call him, he makes enough of a distinction between ministry and office for this reason. He wants to say that, okay, once you're the pope, you have this moral obligation, or you have this, in fact, even maybe even juridical obligation, to pastor the flock, care for the flock, pray for all the souls in the universal church. He wants to say, however, whenever you renounce the See of Peter, though you aren't still the pope, you still have a moral obligation to pray for the universal church. And that is distinct from writing encyclicals and teaching and governing the universal church. So the distinction is important.
I see. Yeah.
It's important because he wants to say he still has a moral, maybe not a juridical, but a moral obligation to pray for the entire church, which is why he still wears the white cassock, which is why he's still called Your Holiness, not because he's still in the office. Not because he's still the pope, but because once you have become a pope, you have that obligation to pray for the universal church, and he still retains that obligation, though maybe not juridically, but morally. So that's why he has that distinction.
Yes. So you can't undo the fact that you – it's not, in other words, like you know, Barack Obama was president and now Barack Obama is not president anymore. Mm-hmm. But there was no change in his permanent he's a private citizen now. But in the papacy is not merely an office that can be taken up and put down like that. It's also a kind of – familial role within the church that can't be. It's like, I used to be your uncle, but I'm not your uncle anymore. Well, you can't do that. So it's both an office in the world with these worldly functions and a familial position that just can't be surrendered.
Right. The office can be renounced.
Yeah.
And can be vacated.
Right.
But the obligation to pray for the universal church and things of that sort remain whenever you're elevated to the papacy. It doesn't mean that you're no longer the pope if you've validly offered a resignation. You are, in fact, no longer the pope, but you still have that moral obligation to pray for the universal church. And that's effectively what Ratzinger is doing, or Benedict XVI or Emeritus. Now, we might say, okay, that makes sense, but it sure seems perhaps even imprudent to still wear a white cask or be called Your Holiness in light of the confusion. Maybe we could offer that criticism, perhaps. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that he still thinks he's the Pope. It just means that he thinks he still has a moral obligation to pray for the universal church. But that doesn't mean that there's a defect in the resignation.
No, as a matter of fact, I think I'm among those who have said, I don't know if I've said it publicly, but I don't see any reason why you couldn't modify that, what he wears to have some other color involved in it, or just be another color if you want to, you know, but so that it doesn't look papal. But I think that would be, but I mean, the frank truth is every Norbertine priest, every Dominican priest looks like a pope as well. So it's not the biggest deal in the world, but, it seems to me it would be more reasonable not to wear the white once you've left the office.
I agree with you. I think that obviously this is within the bounds of what he's able to do if the current pope doesn't have a problem with it. But we could maybe ask, is this the most prudent thing to do in our current situation today? And I think legitimate criticism can be offered there. Perhaps this wasn't the most prudent thing to do.
Okay, and likewise with Holy Father or being addressed that way, that we might have just come up with another term. Right. I mean, because Holy Father, in a certain sense, is a term of endearment. I mean, the word "holy" is there to remind us that he's the father of the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. But Father is a very endearing term that's meant to endear us to him and him to us. But we could have used some other endearing term, maybe
some other, but at the same time, I'm okay with us offering something to distinguish him from just another cardinal or something, because after all, he is a former pope. He did hold that office, so I'm fine with him having some kind of way to distinguish himself. I just want to be prudent about it.
I think formerly Holy Father would not work because okay, so the distinction there then is not just idle talk. There is a distinction between these things.
And
there's a way in which the papacy is permanent. It's, I mean, not a, it, I, it's not a permanent.
Moral obligation.
The papal obligation is permanent. Yeah.
But a moral obligation to pray.
Yeah. But wouldn't you say that our obligation to a person who has been the pope is different as well, in that this person has represented Christ as his vicar on earth, that person is due a kind of place of honor among us, a very high place of honor among us.
Well, certainly. And this is the position that's confirmed by Ganswein, who is the personal secretary to Emeritus. He has noted that, yes, it's clear Pope Benedict is no longer the pope. He has renounced the office. To make this rigid distinction between ministry and office is illegitimate. He's in no way, shape, or form the pope, and Pope Francis is the pope. He's made that clear. But in the same breath, he can go and say, but the reason why he wears the white cassock Benedict. The reason why he wears the white cassock and is called Your Holiness is because he retains a moral obligation. He doesn't necessarily use the word moral obligation. He just says obligation. But he retains an obligation to pray for the universal church. But that should not be interpreted rigidly in the sense that he has this juridical obligation as if he's still in the office of the papacy. That would be a problem. But that's not what Genswein is saying. He's not saying that he's bound to do this because he's still pope. He's just saying, look, if you've once been a pope, you really have that obligation to the universal church, whether you're in that office or not. If you've taken that office, you've taken on that office for life. If for some reason you have to resign, you should at least retain a moral obligation to pray for the universal church.
Okay. So, I appreciated your distinction. You're pointing out that you can have a distinction, but that doesn't mean the thing is separable into two persons. And the example of Jesus himself is a very good one. That you have a very clear distinction between a human and divine nature, but you don't divide the person. You can't that can't be two different people holding. You know, oh, you're gonna. That's like you said. It's Nestorian to say you'll be the human Jesus, and I'll be the divine Jesus. So you can't say you'll be the Pope with the ministry, and I'll be the Pope with the office. Right. That seems quite clear. Are there other arguments that you might want to marshal to help the person who's still unsure about that?
Well, I would say that ultimately, because some might still push back and say, but there's certain problems, linguistic problems in the text of the resignation. This is another big one that I've heard. What I would want to still say is words only have meaning in their context. And when you look at the resignation speech, whatever Pope Benedict says, he's saying the intention is to completely vacate the papacy, to completely vacate the office, because he's saying the see is going to be empty, said of Vacante, and a new pope will need to be elected. So whatever problems we might see allegedly in the text when it comes to the language, you have to ultimately look at intention. Because as I noted, what the canon notes, canon law notes in canon 332, he just simply needs to make it freely and manifest. And he does both of those things. It doesn't say that he has to do it very articulately and cross all your T's, dot all your I's. It doesn't say that. It just simply, he needs to do it freely and make it manifest. Now, others might say, but he was forced out and it wasn't free. And my response is, okay, well, what do you say when Pope Benedict himself tells you that it was free? Mm-hmm. Well, others might say, well, he's being held hostage by the Vatican. Or
well,
something
yeah,
like
that's,
that. But
if you want to have if you need a level of proof where essentially you would have to get him into your own house, know that he's safe and secure, and interview him, that you're not going to get that level of certainty.
Yeah, I don't think that we could have the moral certitude to say that he is being forced to say these things.
There you go. Okay, right, and the burden would be there when all the evidence seems to point in the other direction.
Certainly.
Okay, so Pope Francis is the Pope. It does seem to me that. There's a kind of that this would not come up before we started talking, you phrased it better than I'm going to phrase it right now. But this wouldn't even come up as an issue if people were satisfied that that Francis is a good and actually. I want to say almost safe. He seems unsafe in a certain sense, I think, to many people, in the sense that he's supposed to be the defender and the protector of the unity of the faith. And many people just have a visceral sense, this guy does not get that that's his job and he's not doing it. So, but none of this would come up if he weren't that kind of a figure.
I think that's the impetus behind this. People are rightly scandalized. They're rightly upset by some things that they have seen. That's understandable. But I think what is ultimately driving this idea that Pope Francis isn't the Pope is that discontent, that scandalization, the fact that people have been emotionally scandalized by whatever they have seen, whether they've understood it properly or not. I think that's where this is coming from. I don't think that anybody would have said, let's say if Pope Francis was the best pope ever in the history of the papacy. Okay. Do you think that a person would really look at the resignation speech of Benedict and say, look, no, there's some flaws here. This doesn't make sense. I don't think anybody would have really done that. The no. only reason why, in my opinion, people have gone behind and looked at this and started to question it is because they're looking for a reason to say that Pope Francis is the Pope, isn't the Pope, because they don't know how to reconcile Amoris Laetitia, Pachamama, and things like that. How do I reconcile that with what I know to be true about the papacy? They're unable to do that. They're struggling with those things. So they're looking for a reason to say, okay, he's not the Pope. Now, in addition to this issue with the resignation speech and the Ministerium Munus, there are other reasons why some might say Pope Francis isn't the Pope, which we can get into. But one of them is, I'll just briefly mention, one of them is the claim that there was a conspiracy to elect Pope Francis prior to the conclave. And the claim is that that conspiracy invalidated his papacy. So even if we toss out the ministry office argument, people would still say, but there's a problem with this conspiracy. And I'm more than happy to get into that if you want.
Well, let's do that so briefly, because just because we are here, and I do think there's a certain way in which you one part of your brain wants to go, let's just separate these things out one at a time. But another way you think, well, there's just this kind of preponderance of things that create a suspicion in the mind, including a lightning hitting the Vatican. I think hitting St. Peter's. Was it on the day that Benedict resigned?
Of the resignation.
So I gotta say that freaks you out a little bit. Like, you know, you're like, really? Like, this is the universal sign of God's displeasure with something is lightning hitting it.
Sure.
And there it is. So it does create this kind of a mental state of alertness. Okay. So now I'm in that mental state of alertness. What's going on here? What exactly is that? Is there something I should be attending to? And then, and then you bring up this point about the conspiracy. So what might you say about that, about the conspiracy?
Yeah. And as far really quickly about the lightning strike, these things can be interpreted in multiple ways. I mean, it could say that God wasn't pleased with Benedict resigning. That doesn't mean that he didn't fully resignate in God's eyes and that Pope Francis isn't the Pope. It just could be that God wanted him, you know, in a certain sense, God would say, no, it would have been better for you to have remained the Pope. It doesn't automatically equal, however, that the vacation of the papacy was somehow invalid or something like that. So when it comes to those kinds of signs, you can always interpret them in many ways. So those things are too subjective for me. I need objective stuff that I can really measure these things by. I can't go with the subjective stuff like that because of how they can be interpreted. And as far as the pontificate of Pope Francis, whether or not he was validly elected in light of potentially a conspiracy to elect him, let's just go ahead and grant that there was a conspiracy for a moment, though I can't challenge that. Let's just go ahead and grant it.
Sure.
When you look at the document, Universi Dominici Gregis by John Paul II, that really deals with issues involving cardinals who are not to do things like this, not to engage in these kind of conspiracies. It simply notes, however, that they are not bound to any of these oaths, perhaps, that they've even taken to elect this person. Those are null and void. But John Paul II never says that the conclave, because of that, is null and void. The only time you ever see him say that the conclave is null and void is in the context of problems with the actual ballot in the voting procedures, not issues that took place prior to the voting procedures. And this is stuff that my reading here of the document is that which is, you know, read and understood in the same way that canonist Ed Peters understands it. He wants to say this, that the prohibition against excommunicated cardinals voting in a conclave, he wants to say that only goes against the licentiousness but not the validity of the ballot, meaning, you know, if you have some kind of cardinal who engaged in this kind of conspiracy, even if they're excommunicated because of that, they're still able to validly vote for a pope, even though they're excommunicated, they're still able to validly vote for a pope, but not licitly. In other words, the election is valid, it just wasn't done licitly. The key here, though, is there is a universal principle that theologians have long recognized, known as universal and peaceful acceptance of a pope, where even if you have some kind of canonical problem in an election of a pope, if the faithful have universally received a person, and most certainly Francis meets that description, if they have received his pontificate just initially at the time of the election, that heals in the root any kind of canonical defects, even if they were present. In other words, I don't see a canonical reason to say that he isn't the pope. I don't see a theological reason to say that he isn't the pope. So we
come back then to, I suppose, where we began. You're perfectly fine to say he's not a good pope. I don't like him as a pope. You know, as long as you're not causing scandal or schism in the church, to say, to the degree that you're making a legitimate criticism, make whatever criticism you want.
Right,
but it's not even a defense of his papacy in any way to say, however, he's the pope.
Right. Yeah. And I do think that at this point we should offer some legitimate and fair and charitable criticism. I don't think that we should merely be silent. I do think that we should challenge some things from the present pontificate. But I just want to make sure it is done in a charitable and fair way, because sometimes, not all, but sometimes Pope Francis is being misrepresented. Sometimes he is being misreported. Not all the time, but sometimes.
No, right.
And so sometimes we maybe jump the gun and criticize him when in fact, that's not exactly what he said. We do need to be fair to him, even if we have problems with him elsewhere.
Yeah, right, right. And we're still on it. I would assume that the commandment to honor your father and mother, it applies to everyone who is in a position of authority over us or in a position of honor above us. And that we're required, I mean, it's a very serious matter to follow that commandment. There's no getting excused from that commandment.
Yeah, I think the spiritual application most certainly applies to the papacy. It applies also to our local bishop, our local priest. That doesn't mean we can't charitably criticize them in the same way that we could charitably challenge and criticize our own parents.
No.
But we need to do it charitably and fairly and accurately.
I hope my children are listening. Michael Lofton, the hardest working man in apologetics, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was an honor.
Get ready to be criticized on the internet for this.
I already am.
Yeah. No, I'm sure. Right. And you know what? It's perfectly legitimate to charitably and helpfully criticize Michael Lofton too.
That's fine. And I'm fine with hearing pushback. I just want to hear it fairly done, charitably done. That's the key. Yeah.
Well, stay off Twitter then. All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Many people have, in fact, come to the conclusion that Pope Francis is a bad pope. But as even the person that comes to that conclusion that Pope Francis is a bad pope has to distinguish between defending a particular pope and defending a theology of the papacy, that it's a true theology of the papacy. So here in this episode, I hope we have done that. I hope we have just stayed away from the whole question of whether or not Francis is a good or a bad pope, and simply defended the theology, the proper theology of the papacy, so that we can have a healthy view of what the papacy is. I hope we've done that. If you disagree, or if you'd like to point out other points that we didn't get to, send us an email, focus@catholic.com, focus@catholic.com. If you're watching on YouTube, you know what to do. Hit that little bell so you'll be notified in future episodes. Subscribe so that we can help grow the podcast. And if you're watching or if you listen on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or one of the other podcast services, then like and subscribe, and that way you'll be notified. If you'd give us that 5-star review, that will also help grow the podcast. And if you'd be so kind as to support us financially, you can do that at givecatholic.com. Once again, I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.